Paranormal Perception presents Women in the Paranormal is yet another audio creation from 22 Creations Multimedia, LLC.
Paranormal Perception presents Women in the Paranormal. These are standalone once-a-month episodes highlighting women and their contributions to the paranormal community. Here's your host, Amanda Ashley.
Welcome back, everyone. On this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Varla Ventura. Varla is a writer, traveler, rotten botanist, and lover of the strange. She's authored 6 books, from the history of paranormal parlor games, to plants that smell like corpses, to mermaids, vampires, banshees, and other creepy creatures of the fairy realm. We'll talk about her 7th and latest book later on in this episode. Varla is a committed supernaturalist, folklorist, and seeker of those shadowy things that scrape at your window in the dead of night. Welcome to Women in the Paranormal, Varla.
Why, thank you. I'm honored to be here.
So we'll go ahead and start with, you know, at the very beginning, like all good things should. And could you tell everybody what first drew you to the world of the paranormal?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I was sort of born into it. My mom is a witch, and she has always been sort of a seeker of, you know, she's the age of Aquarius, right? So she's always been a seeker of sort of like higher knowledge from the other side. So I grew up in a house where tarot cards were on the shelf, as were books by Dion Fortune and Aleister Crowley and Sybil Leek, all the kind of like classics of the occult. And none of those things were censored from me. And I also spent a lot of time, we always went to cemeteries. We did all kinds of psychic parlor games. And I just thought this was my norm. I didn't really think anything of it until I got a little bit older and realized, oh, other people go to like church and stuff.
Would you have friends come over and would it be abnormal to them, or was there like crossover with other kids going like, what? You're doing what? Walking through what cemetery?
Yeah, I would say like when I was a younger kid, I don't think where I grew up, from about 7 to 17, we were basically in the middle of the woods. Oh. So we spent very little time inside. So I think it was kind of a non-issue because we were all just running around outside, you know, pretending we were elves or something like that. ElfQuest was real big in my school at the time.
Right.
That was a lot of fun. But then, like, when I was a teenager, actually, then I sort of started gravitating toward other people who had maybe not the same kind of upbringing, but certainly more similar interests. You know, there was all the town goths that hung out in the cemeteries and stuff like that. But I had a couple of friends who, you know, their parents were professional astrologers or artists and musicians. And I mean, to this day, my friends all, you know, get tarot readings from my mom. She's really good at it. So, yeah, it became fairly normal, I guess. And then, yeah, so I've bonded with those who are also lovers of the, you know, hanging out in cemeteries and things. But I don't know how many people went with their mom when they were 4 years old to like eat sandwiches in a cemetery on a regular basis. You know, I don't know how many people I know that have experienced that, but quite a few people that, you know, teenage years on love being in cemeteries. But I was just, yeah, exposed to it really young. And what we would do is we would walk around. This was in the San Francisco Bay Area, actually, and out in Colma. And so we lived kind of like in Daly City, and we would, my mom didn't have a washer and dryer, so we would go to the laundromat, and in between cycles, we'd go and get some kind of deli sandwich, and then we'd sit in the cemetery and we'd eat them, and then we'd walk around while everything was in the dryer or whatever. And we would walk around, and we had a couple relatives that we would sometimes visit, but because Colma has, you know, it's more dead citizens than living. It's where they moved all the cemeteries from San Francisco to in the 1930s. So there's just tons. It's like cemetery after cemetery. And we would just go to different ones, but we would walk around and we would look at people's names and we would kind of make up stories about them and speculate who they might be related to. And, you know, we just had a lot of fun doing it. So it never occurred to me that it was, I mean, I always knew it was a sacred place, but it always felt like a safe place to me. So later in life, when I was, you know, a young woman living on my own in a city I'd never been to before, I would always just gravitate toward the cemetery because they, couple reasons. One, it's basically a park, right? But two, people kind of leave you alone in a cemetery. You're sitting on a public bench in a park and, you know, you're a young woman. Someone's going to come and sit down and start harassing you very likely, right? Sitting in a graveyard, not so much. That's really how you can like weed them out and ward them off. Plus, if you feel like crying, no one's going to judge you.
Right. Right. It sounds like a perfect place. Wow.
Yeah. Perfect haven.
That's so cool. What a cool upbringing. Do you have siblings?
Mm-hmm.
And then are they also,
yes.
Do they also kind of lean towards the same way you do? Are they into the kind of supernatural type stuff?
Definitely all interested in cemeteries.
Okay.
Except maybe like one of my oldest siblings doesn't, I don't think he spends a lot of time in cemeteries. I have five siblings, so
Big
family.
Okay.
But all of us love going to cemeteries. It's something we do regularly when we get together. My family lives in California and I live in Minnesota now. So when I go back, it's like, oh, you want to just go for a walk and we'll just, you know, go to the little Pioneer Cemetery that's down the hill from my sister's house or something. And we, you know, we've been to that cemetery so many times before, but we just like to go there. And
yeah.
And then as far as like, I have three sisters and they're all into horror.
Okay.
And horror movies, horror novels and cemeteries. I wouldn't say they're so much into the supernatural. One of my sisters is pretty interested in like ghosts and stuff and definitely is like probably more in my camp, but, I'm the one that can sit and talk with my mom about occult philosophies for hours on end. And all my other siblings are like, okay, we're going to go do something else. So,
right. Yeah.
As committed supernaturalists, but certainly I'd say like, you know, adjacent to that at least.
But you have an interest. It didn't bypass any of you.
Mm-mm.
Which,
I had a very interesting experience the other day. One of my sisters called me to tell me about some kind of some peril that my little niece was in. And this sister of mine, her husband passed away a few years ago. And so we're talking on the phone. I said, you know what we need to do? We need to get him to intervene somehow. We got to get him to intervene. Like we there's not a lot we can do legally. So we need to get some intervention from, you know, her grandpa.
Yeah.
And so I hung up with my sister. And I was driving to an appointment and I couldn't get my radio to work. And I looked down and it said call in process on my dashboard. And I'm looking down at my phone and my phone's not engaged. There's no one, you know, my sister had hung up. There's no one on the phone. But I can't get my radio to work. So I just took that as I guess this is my opportunity to make my plea. And I just assumed I was talking to my brother-in-law. And I spent the next 10 minutes as I was driving talking to him. I mean, I literally said, we need to get in contact with him. And yeah. A minute later, after I hung up with his wife, the phone basically rang, right? Connected me.
Right.
So I just took that opportunity and, you know, for what it's worth.
Yeah. Ooh, I love this kind of stories. Do you, I know this might be kind of an impossible question to answer, but do you think that if it hadn't been so normalized when you were young, do you think that just you, how you are, you know, how you're born into this world, kind of would have still leaned towards the occult world or the supernatural world? Does that just kind of like feel like home to you?
It does feel like home to me. And I guess that is a bit of an impossible question because there are so many small influences on me in my life that But of course, you know, I could also have rejected those, right? Just like, it, you know, maybe I would have like complained about watching the Addams Family again, or
right.
But I think there are other factors as well. You know, as with anyone, there's different kind of things that happen within your family. For example, both of my grandparents were deaf. They met at the Deaf Club in San Francisco. And they used to do all kinds of interesting, like, parlor games and things like that, where with their deaf friends, where they'd get together around the table and they'd try and levitate it, and they'd think of an object and try and get at the time it was their oldest child was still a boy, and they'd all concentrate on an object and then tell him to go in the other room and get it. So they would do all these perception games. So I think there was some inherent psychic ability in there. I don't really consider myself a psychic or a medium, but I've certainly had psychic experiences. You know, I guess if I had to say for sure, I would probably put myself more in the clairaudient category, where I've heard more things, but I've seen some things.
Yeah.
And felt invisible presences and things like that. So I think there's quite a bit of that going back generations in my family, actually. So yeah, I think some of it's inherited, you know, but also it's the nature versus nurture.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if even your other siblings who weren't, you know, fully immersed, I wouldn't be surprised if everybody didn't have a touch of something going on, whether they're connected
or not. Oh, well, both my brothers are extremely psychic.
Okay.
Extremely psychic.
Interesting.
Yeah. In fact, if I really need to get a hold of my brother, sometimes I just have to, like, think about him real hard.
Just put the vibes out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or if I reach out, he'll be like, I was just thinking about you. I was like, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. That's a nice connection to have with siblings, especially.
Yes, very much so. Very true.
So since you have been kind of in this world for so long, coming into kind of now as an adult, do you find that, like, a lot of attitudes have changed towards the paranormal? I mean, do you kind of feel like it's become more acceptable, with quotes around it, you know, to talk about it and to live in it, than it was when you were younger?
Yes, probably it has become more acceptable, and it's definitely, like, I think it's more common in many ways to just have discussions, but I'm not sure if it's really changed that much, because, you know, if you think about it and you go back toward, like, the history of the spiritualist movement, that you know, was extremely popular from, like, 1840 to 1865, and then it sort of petered out for a little bit, and then it made a second resurgence in, you know, the early 1900s. And so I think what we have today in terms of the paranormal is built on all of those things. But as far as, like, you know, what I personally have seen, I mean, I worked in paranormal book publishing 20 years ago. So I do think it's more popular.
Right. Popular. Yeah, that might be a
good way to say it. It's definitely more popular.
Right.
Has it really become more acceptable? Maybe.
Maybe a smidge more acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people like the sort of the ghost hunting aspect of it. And I'm not really very immersed in that world. I mean, I've done a couple of investigations, but that's not really what I do. I love to go to haunted places. I love to go to old places. I love to go to cemeteries. If there's a reputation for it being haunted, I'm there. But also for me, the experiences that I've had have never been in a place that's reputed to be haunted. It's always in a place, except maybe one. It's always been in other places, like an old hotel, you know, that we just happened to overnight in, or in the cemetery near my house or something. There's no history of it being haunted per se. And I think that that's probably really common, that yes, you can go to places and have experiences and places are haunted for reasons. But I think a lot of people have paranormal experiences in a much more unexpected location. Not to say you can't seek it out, but for me, it's always come in a more unexpected. I had a couple of strange experiences at this hotel in San Antonio. It's called St. Anthony, actually. And normally I do a lot of research, but my sister and I were going down there to visit our elderly uncle. And so I think I did like a Priceline thing, you know, but remember back when you could just blindly bid really low and they would just send you to a 4-star hotel and you had no idea where you were going.
I sure do.
Yeah, that was fun. So that's where we ended up. And I had a couple different, I had an experience in the bathroom in our room. And then on the top floor, I saw like a sort of a dark, like a, almost like a woman in like Victorian garb or something, like rush from one door over to the elevators. And it was so real that I walked down there because I knew something was off about it, because she looked kind of Victorian-ish. And I was like, either I want to see this lady's outfit or I want to make sure that that was real. And when I got to the, you know, a few paces down the hall, there was no one waiting at the elevators, and, you know, the elevators hadn't come yet or anything.
Oh, yeah.
But like then later I found out that there was like someone committed suicide in that hotel. And there was like a bunch of like, you know, hauntings going on, none of which were related to what I saw. So sometimes I think it's fun to go into those places not knowing too much and see what you experience.
Yeah, I agree. I worked for many years on the Queen Mary, and
and
see, that is always the reaction that people get. And let me tell you how many paranormal experiences I had, right? Like, I'm there day in, day out, and I could probably count on one hand because I'm not saying it's not haunted. It is very much haunted, but you can't always get what you want when you want it. You know,
exactly. You can't just walk into a place and say,
I can't
come
just
on,
be
ghost.
There all the time and they're constantly bothering me. Like, and also I'm not incredibly sensitive, so maybe that's another thing. But I would be there day in, day out, and nothing would happen and nothing, you know, and then once in a while a little something or not. And then I can be walking in, you know, a strip mall out on like a main on a main street to Shoe City to grab, you know, my kids some shoes. And here comes this like, you know, disembodied voice out of nowhere. And it's like, wait a minute. We're standing here in the middle of it, you know, in front of a shoe store. And there's no reason for that, you know?
Right.
I do feel like there is sometimes that like expectation versus what you're thinking.
Versus reality. Versus
where open you are, or how there's like, I don't know. I don't like to make it sound, I think sometimes it can be really simple, but also sometimes I think it's just like a certain criteria has to be happening for things to happen once in a while.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and also kind of to that point, like, I think it happening kind of unexpected is often like usually is often sort of the thing that's more profound. And then the other thing that happens, for at least for me, is that when I have like what I would call a paranormal experience, in that moment I'm not like, sweet, I'm having a paranormal experience right now.
Exactly.
It's like, what's going on? Why do I feel like this? What, you know, like try and explain it away. I was with my mom down in Key West, and we were actually on a ghost tour. And we went to the like haunted shipwreck museum, and they were talking about how there was like a ghost there or something, and had this ghost kept turning up. Not the shipwreck museum. It's like I can't remember what it was called, but it's like this, it's full of like stuff that's been salvaged from wrecks. And they're talking about that. And they were like, if you go up to the fourth floor, that's the haunted floor. And I got in there, and right away I got this like, I mean, I just thought, well, maybe I didn't eat enough or something. You know, I just got this overwhelming sensation in this one specific spot, like pressure, like as if I was underwater, under, you know, at least, you know, 20 feet of water, where you're like coming at the bottom of the pool and you start feeling that pressure, like in your nose and stuff. Right. And it was so strong, I actually had to kind of like grab the railing because I thought I was going to black out for a second. I was like, all right, I must. And again, I'm just thinking like, whoa, I must not have eaten enough. And then I kind of like it sort of passed and I moved away from that spot and I instantly felt better. And I was like, well, that was kind of weird. And I didn't say anything because I wouldn't want to be the person on the ghost tour being like, hey, I just stood in a haunted spot. You know, I just kind of wanted to think about it. And I didn't say anything to my mom because I knew if I said something to my mom, she'd be like, hey, she just felt a haunt. And I was like, no, I just want to.
Right.
So when everybody went to go upstairs, I walked back over and stepped in the same spot and the same thing happened again. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I told my mom the next day or something. She's like, let's go back there.
Yeah.
But it was totally immediately, even in a situation like that, where they're literally talking about ghosts and all this stuff, where I'm just like, it could just be that I didn't, you know, I'm just like.
Of course, out all the other things it could be, right?
And not water? Because I'm a skeptic, but because, you know, it's just, that's just what pops into your head, you know? I was just like, oh, did I leave the window open? You know, did I forget to let the dog out? You know, whatever little things that you think might be causing the strange noises in your head.
Right. Agreed. Absolutely. I'm right there with you. I do the same thing. So aside from ghosts, when you are doing your research for, let's say, other creatures of folklore, you know, of vampires and fairies and werewolves and all of the babies, do you think that it has been kind of beneficial? I'm getting my thoughts in order. The rise of, you know, social media and podcasts and YouTube channels and everything, do you think that it's beneficial that kind of everybody's getting to experience these stories on a wider kind of platform, all the platforms, instead of just, you know, maybe a book or people aren't reading books, but sharing the stories, you know, have you found it to be beneficial across platforms?
I mean, it's personally beneficial. It's not beneficial to my book sales.
Okay, no, not to your book sales.
But absolutely, because I've actually, even with Enchanted Plants, I did a lot of my research, actually, Enchanted Plants, Paranormal Parlor, and the fairy book, there were a number of podcasts that I listened to. And, you know, for example, it's gone now, but there was a Stories of Scotland podcast where these two women took different aspects of sort of Scottish culture and told the kind of story behind it. And that's where I learned about how controversial turnips can be. All of this great stuff. So I think as a researcher, it's beneficial. And also I think for like a general audience, I mean, we have to be aware that everybody consumes things in different ways. And what's particularly nice about podcasts is that, you know, you can listen to it when you are able. So you can, you know, kind of get that information, but you can be at a time when you're able to absorb it. So, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts and stories and stuff when I'm gardening.
Oh, right. When your hands are otherwise busy.
Yeah, when your hands are otherwise occupied. Or, man, housework is so boring. So if I can listen to something really cool that, you know, suddenly I'm transported to another world, or hearing about some kind of like fantastic legend or something, you know, those are all like, I think it is really beneficial. I do think that for me, I'm not like a super active social media person, but with Enchanted Plants, I really kind of started getting more like, I don't know, just getting kind of more into Instagram because I found that there is this like a huge plant community on Instagram, especially people who are into like magic and plants.
Right.
So I've connected through that. I've connected with some incredible people that I probably wouldn't have connected with otherwise. And now that I consider them friends and colleagues and, you know, just like really interesting people that I can have conversations about or send weird seeds to. So I think that's like a huge benefit of social media. For myself, I feel like there's a competitive, I'm like an aggressive person, but I'm not a competitive person. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, but like, I don't really, I like to win, don't get me wrong, but I don't like to feel bad for winning or feel bad for not winning. So there's right. there's a competitiveness in social media, yeah. which is brought out by the, you know, the way it's designed, the algorithm yes. such it, yeah. that, that bums me out sometimes, because, you know, I want to feel inspired, and I try and like what, you know, I try and post when I'm inspired, but yeah, there's this whole idea that you need to like post regularly, which of course you do, but yeah. every once in a while, I'll just find myself being kind of a grumpy old lady about the whole thing.
So it's, yeah, if I had like gun to my head, I would say I hate it, but I also understand it is kind of part of the world now. And so
yeah.
it's a double-edged sword. There's great things on it, and there's horrible things on it, and there's horrible people, and there's great people. So,
well, interestingly, I lost my Facebook page this week for reasons I have yet to determine.
Okay.
And I'm it's just gone. They just got rid of it. And I don't know if it has, I'm like, honestly, at this point, just taking that like, unplug your computer and count to 10, but I'm right. taking like the week long approach to that yeah. of like, okay, I'm going to, I mean, I sent in a query and everything, but it's like, this is a glitch.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to believe that it's going to be miraculously restored. And yeah. if it isn't, then I'm okay. What do I do? Do I rebuild it? Do I just let it go? You know, I mean, it was a little bit like a little liberating
yeah,
in some ways. Yeah.
Right, it probably feels kind of good,
but also not yeah. great, because I don't have a ton of followers, but I'm also about to go out on like a book tour.
Right.
And it is a way that I communicate with a lot of people at once. And some of the yes. places where I'm doing talks have created shared events with me and stuff, and any little yeah. bit of promotion helps. And
yeah.
Instagram isn't really a great place to say, here's a link to the show I was on. It doesn't yeah. have the right format for that. You know, you have to put your link in the bio or whatever. I guess right. there's ways to do it. But you know, it's just not as easy. Yeah, so,
correct.
But anyway, that's kind of funny. So I was like, all right, well, okay. I'm moderately upset. I'm more annoyed about it, but there's this part of me that just like believes it'll be restored. And it's probably like yeah. the really foolish optimist in me.
I don't think they move with any urgency from what I've seen people complaining when they're,
yeah.
There's no urgency, absolutely no urgency.
Oh, and it's very difficult to even like find someone to contact. I finally had to right. go into like this very specific part of an old account and say, hey, do you see what happens? Because I didn't get, you know, there was no notification of a violation. Possibly I was hacked. I was given a password reset. Really? Which I did, and then that's when the page disappeared. So I have a personal account and then a like public page. So that's what disappeared, was the public page. So yeah, so this week I died a little bit in terms of social media. But you know, yeah. I actually, yeah. you know, it's just Scorpio moon coming up. Oh, we're just yes. going to like go yes. with it, you know. Full moon Scorpio, we're just
that's right.
going to embrace it. And
it.
Yeah, yeah.
So speaking of your books, so when did you first decide, you know what, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to take all my knowledge and I'm going to do something with it.
Well,
not that you were doing anything before, but in a specific book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because I actually, the only thing I've ever wanted to be my whole life, with maybe a brief period in eighth grade when I wanted to be like president of the United States or something.
Right.
I mean, as long as I can remember, all I've ever wanted to be is a writer. So my goal was to be a writer. For some reason, as many of us do, I think, in my mind, that meant a certain kind of writer. I think it meant a novelist. That's what I was like thinking. I'd be like a fiction novelist.
Yeah.
And I was actually interning at a book publisher. And I kind of raised my hands. I have an idea. Because I had always been one of those people that just like collected weird facts and tidbits and things and like bizarre trivia.
Yeah.
And I was like, what about a book of bizarre, like a trivia book, but like bizarre trivia with like, you know, some hauntings in there and some, you know, stories and like strange facts, and I don't know, just like just kind of brought it to them like that.
Yeah.
And they hooked me up with this wonderful editor named Rachel Leach. And she and I hashed out that first book of the Bazaar. And that's kind of how I started writing what I guess would be considered nonfiction. And then it sort of evolved from there. That one did well, so we did a second one. And then I wasn't there anymore, but I I had secretly put in all of these ideas into the system.
Okay.
Like there's this system called FileMaker, and basically for every book title that you were going to be working with, you created a title information sheet, and you could put what year you thought it would come out, and you could actually kind of use that as a placeholder for like a pretty viable idea, but you didn't know when it was going to come out.
Okay.
And so I put some of my ideas on there, and I put like a future date. And then with that, one of them specifically was the fairy book, and the current editor, this was at Wiser Books, called me up and she was like, "Hey, I found this thing in FileMaker. Would you be interested in writing this?" Just no idea that I put it in. I was like, "Yeah, I would love to. I love that idea.
What a brilliant idea!
Genius! I love it. When do you need it by?"
That's amazing.
So, but that's kind of that was kind of my entryway. And then, as far as like the sort of like magical creatures and the paranormal parlor stuff, I was hired by the book publisher, that same book publisher, to create a series of ebooks. This is when like ebooks were becoming a thing.
Yeah.
To create a series of ebooks, and we had two umbrellas. We had magical creatures and we had paranormal parlor. And the criteria was basically like a short story or tale or something. And then you took those, and then I framed them in like modern terms or modern context. And those did not do tremendously well, but they served as research for the mermaid book, Among the Mermaids, Banshees, Werewolves, and Vampires, and then Paranormal Parlor actually all kind of came out of some of that research. So it wasn't for naught that that I did all of that work.
Yeah.
But it just, you know, I think my audience is a tactile audience.
Yes.
So my physical books have always done better than any kind of ebook sales.
Right. I'm actually the same way, much to the sadness of my family. There's, you know, stacks of books everywhere. So
yes,
I understand that.
I have a lot of books, and I have a very tall to be read pile.
Yes.
And I do read things. Like when I'm researching, sometimes you just can't, like, I don't know, sometimes I just think of or learn of a book and I just can't get it fast enough.
Yeah.
For the speed at which I want to consume it. And so I will read that, you know, like if it's like an old book, I can read it online on like Gutenberg, or I don't have a Kindle, but I have, I bought one for my dad.
Yeah.
And so when you do that, when you own one, you actually can, when you buy a book for that, you can read it online. Like you can open a tab on your Amazon account and read it on your computer. But it was really funny because when I was researching, I did that a few times with Enchanted Plants. And my dad, he likes I'll just put books on there sometimes for him. And he likes like old Westerns and stuff, like he's, you know, or like John Grisham. And every yes. once in a while, there'd be like the occult principles of herbalism or something would just show up on his Kindle.
Yes,
he's never said anything. I was always kind of waiting for him to say something. I was like, you see that weird book that popped up there?
No, it didn't bother him any.
Yeah, he didn't notice. Yeah, it's like the injustice of, you know, witchcraft and midwifery and 1682 or something. He's just like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
He'll just scroll right by
it. How did I get on there?
So it doesn't sound like it, but I will ask, because this is Women in the Paranormal. Have you gotten any pushback about kind of just being a woman in the space?
Oh, yeah.
Have you got okay?
Oh, yeah.
I always kind of feel like, well, I want to ask you, but also I don't want to be too weird about it. But I know sometimes
you
push back on knowledge.
You know what?
Publishing, to your point, all kinds of things.
Yeah, to your point, when you were asking, has it changed? That's actually a way it's changed for the better. Okay. When I started, especially in like occult publishing, it was a boys' club.
Okay.
Big time. Still kind of is.
Yeah.
But I think that there are more women and women who recognize that and are supporting each other.
Yes.
Versus, competing with each other. And so that is a big change. I think women are a lot more, because I'm sorry, but the paranormal, the psychic arts belong to women. Historically belonged to women. And the spiritualist movement was built by women. So, but in the last, 30 years, it's been dominated by men.
Yeah.
Ghost hunting men, mostly.
Well, right? I'm not
criticizing. I like those ghost hunting men, you know? Yeah. They're my type. I get it. You know, right. So it's fine. But yes. I do think, okay, so I'll give you a great example. So there's a story that, so I wrote an issue of Jeff Bellinger's Shadow Zine. And I wrote specifically about this woman named Emily Grant Hutchings, my issue number 3, and it's Mark Twain's Ouija Mystery. Mm-hmm. And it's about a woman who channeled a novel via the Ouija board that she claimed came from the ghost of Mark Twain. She started it about 6 years after he died.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I am familiar with that story.
It's an amazing story.
It is.
But in my experience, I wrote about it a little bit in Paranormal Parlor. But in my experience, all of the articles and research that I have read about it over the years, by and large, is written either from a very skeptical point of view or written from a male point of view, not necessarily written by men, but there is a lack of understanding of the context of women's history and what it was like to put yourself out on the line in a situation like that, or try and achieve any kind of accomplishment where you weren't just Mrs. So-and-so.
Right.
And so when I worked on this, that was something that I felt like was missing in the story about her. For example, her being accused of just feeling jilted and competitive with the Pearl Koran, who was channeling Patience Worth at the time.
That's right. Right.
But the thing is, she's the one who introduced Pearl to the Ouija board. She brought a Ouija board to her house. They made contact with Patience Worth together. Right. Patience came to Pearl in a session with Emily. And not only that, but they were writing their work simultaneously. So Patience Worth's greatest novel, or her greatest work, was called The Sorry Tale. And it came out in 1917. That's the same year that Emily's book came out. So they were actually working simultaneously. In addition to that, Emily Grant Hutchings had a thriving journalism career, mainstream journalism career. Yeah. So I immediately rejected the idea that she was just trying to do what that's one of the theories that's been put forth, that she was just trying to, she saw her friend doing well and she wanted to do that too.
Yeah.
So I reject that idea because I don't think that is true. I think that they were both doing the same thing at the same time. And they were friends. So yeah. I don't know why she wouldn't be thrilled for her friend. Emily's problem was that actually, it turned out that there was a man who was harassing Twain's daughter during the sessions. He kept writing to her and saying, hey, can you verify this? Can you verify that? So much so that it got to the point that it irritated Clara. And she referred him. She said, you can talk to my lawyers. And he sent her like 6 or 7 letters. So this is all unknown to Emily while she's doing these sessions. This guy's taking notes and then sending them off. So when the time came to publish it, Harper and Brothers and the lawyers of the Clemens estate were all over it, because this guy had actually basically agitated the pot, because other people had done things under, claiming Mark Twain, and mm-hmm. they had let it go and not said anything. So again, like a little bit of a different perspective there versus just this woman who was like the woman that was desperate for attention and was crazy is kind of how she was billed. So yeah. I just wanted to like break that apart a little bit. And I don't know, right? I'm speculating,
but of course,
I'm speculating from a different perspective, at least.
I agree. And in the obviously much less research that I've done on it, I've listened to some podcasts on it. It also has always struck me how people were kind of like these women. I mean, they just, I mean, I don't even know what word to use, dumbasses, like basically saying like, there's no way their education, there's no way they would be able to. And I'm just like,
right,
guys, like women can be multiple things at once, you know,
that
like,
right.
Like she doesn't need to be classically trained in this certain thing to be able to do this. It just, the way that the women were spoken about is very strange to me. It's very strange.
Oh yes. And then also to kind of go back to your question about like the pushback, I have experienced situations where, for example, I was invited on a specific radio show, and I was harassed for agreeing to go on that radio show. I won't get into like all the details of it, but I was harassed for getting, I was called names, and someone called me like a demonic or witch, and someone said I was going to ruin my reputation. And I'm like, oh, what, all two people who are reading this post, you know, come on. Right. And of course I went on the show anyway, because it was this woman who's a host. I love her. She's an excellent interviewer. I love talking to her, and we would kind of be, I'd be on her show every couple of years. Plus I'd been on her show multiple times before. And what I found was very interesting is that there had been two male guests. She kind of relaunched her show. There had been two male guests, fairly well known in the paranormal community, and they were not harassed. People weren't making comments on their page and asking them to, you know, make a public statement about why you shouldn't go on this show. It was immediately because I was a woman and she was a woman, and she and I talked about that, and she was like, oh, I know what guy that was. He stalks me. That guy that called you that, he's one of my stalkers. So I think it's the same story, different genre, right?
Absolutely.
You definitely see that.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just being a woman, you know.
It just evolves. Yeah, it just evolves a little bit, and with technology and kind of,
and disguises itself a little bit too.
Very much
so. Yeah.
Very much so. It's just a different, same thing, different form.
Yes.
That's how it goes. So it goes.
So, I mean, I think that is a way specifically that the paranormal community, and just to be clear, like, we're not talking about like, you know, witches and pagans and stuff like that. We're talking specifically about the paranormal community, the kind of, you know, the ghost hunting community.
Yes.
You know, and that I have found to be much more welcoming to women, and more women supporting each other, and more women just like really kind of taking the lead.
Yeah.
More and more. And also, you know, just kind of, yeah, like doing things like this, you know, where it's like talking about women in the paranormal.
Yeah.
Because it is a different experience than being in the paranormal community.
It is very much. Yeah. And everybody, you know, everybody's experience is valid, and some people feel it.
Well, is everyone's experience valid?
Well, if I invite them here, I am validating your experience.
Yes. Okay. On your show, yes.
Of course, because you know what? Some people do not have those experiences. And maybe they don't notice them. Maybe it just is not a thing for them. But, you know, it's, I talk to a lot of people, and it is a range of answers for things like that.
So. Yeah. No, that's absolutely,
you know,
true.
I mean?
And of course, that's not to say that there haven't been women who have been prominent in the paranormal community for the last 30 years. I mean, look at Patty Negri. I mean, she's the queen, you know?
Yes.
So, absolutely. I have found that the witches have been the strongest in that light, for sure. Because witches don't take any shit, you know.
Yes.
Like, I have, like, they know they have something that like a person with a EVP thing doesn't have, right?
There's absolutely. Like,
okay, get out of the way. Let me clear the room.
That's right. It's a gift.
She's so powerful. I just love her.
Yes. Yes, she is amazing. So your newest book kind of goes into a different area of folklore, which is botanical folklore and magics.
Yes.
So can you give us a little summary about what that is and how your book kind of goes into it?
Yeah, definitely. So my most recent book, Enchanted Plants, and that's exactly what it's called, Enchanted Plants, A Treasury of Botanical Folklore and Magic. And this book, so I've been a plant person since as long as I can remember. I have a lot of very early visceral memories of doing specific things in the garden or learning about herbs with my mom. And a lot of my early career was spent in retail nurseries and landscaping and mowing lawns and things like that. So in many ways, I've kind of been working on this book for, you know, years and years and years. But what happened is several years ago, during COVID, I was reading through a big old volume of Grimm's fairy tales. And I kind of started just taking note of specific plants that were popping up repeatedly in different stories. And I started thinking, wouldn't it be cool to take sort of a botanical lens on fairy tales and folklore so that essentially the plants that I've included in the book have met, at least for me, met the criteria that they are the main character or you know, primary character, at least, in whatever story I've chosen for that section. And without that plant, the story would change. If you changed the plant or removed the plant, the story would change. And so that was kind of like how I, that was my vision. So there were some that were very obvious from the get-go. Now, the truth is every plant has a story. There's a reason that, you know, its common name tells a story. Its botanical name tells a story. There's lore behind all kinds of, you know, like pretty much every plant, there's lore behind. But I really wanted to find plants, again, that were like, the focus was kind of on like a good solid myth or fairy tale, or multiple ones that were centered around this particular plant. And so there's, you know, I've got flowers and fruits and trees and shrubs and all kinds of things in the book. So then when I got to sort of start organizing the book, the way it's arranged is it's arranged by the type of garden you might come upon in a fairy tale. Okay. So you start out in the queen's garden, and then you go round back to the kitchen garden. And then you sneak out in the moonlight to the witch's garden. And of course, that's where all the poisonous plants are. And if you can survive that, you head into the meadow and then into the woods. And then eventually you hit the sea or the lake. And so there's some aquatic plants toward the end. And so I kind of organized it in that way. And each chapter is, you know, one of those types of gardens. And then within that chapter, there's a handful of plants. And then I've given you the common names, the botanical names, the medicinal properties, the magical properties, and then the lore. And my favorite example is actually Rapunzel, because there is a plant called rampion, and it is a leafy green. It gets beautiful little flowers, and it's something that used to be eaten like as commonly as arugula or kale or something is eaten today. And I don't know if you remember this in the story of Rapunzel, but the whole reason that that the witch gets the baby and then is able to lock Rapunzel up in the tower, is because the Rapunzel's mother is craving this, plant that grows in the witch's garden. And she cons her husband into sneaking over the fence and getting some for her. And the witch catches him and says, "You have to give me your firstborn child."
Yes, he agrees. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So this plant is very important to that. Well, I knew I was going to include Rapunzel because I started like reading different versions of it, different translations. And I was just remembering that whole beginning of the story that was totally, you know, it was completely plant-based. And I found two different versions of the Grimm's fairy tales. In one of them, it said, instead of saying a bed of rampion, it said a bed of Rapunzel. And then in another one, it said, it actually said Rapunzel is the German word for rampion. So that plant was called Rapunzel. So that's actually where the Grimm brothers got the name of the character. Okay. From the plant.
That's so cool. Okay, interesting.
So that for me is like my prime example of like that story would not exist were it not for that plant. We wouldn't even have that character's name right. if it weren't for that plant. Now that character is synonymous with the long flowing braid and everything we think of when we think of Rapunzel, let down your hair. But it's because of a plant that that came about.
Did this book take? Was this longer to research and kind of cross-reference all? This feels like so many levels that you're having to hit.
Yeah, it took me 5 years, really.
Oh my goodness.
It took me a solid year of just writing. Okay. And then the other years were spent researching, bookmarking thing. You know, it took me a week just to put my bibliography together because I had done it in this absolutely chaotic way that I don't, I mean, I had... you know, books in my own collection that I had had all the post-its and stuff in. I had stacked those up. And then I had library books, but some of them were, I couldn't renew anymore. And so I took photos of, I had stacks of library books, and then I had photos of the book and the copyright page, because you have to include all that. And then I had online sources, including articles and a lot of medical journals. And then I had public domain online sources like from Gutenberg. And so I just had like tons of articles and some YouTube videos and some podcasts. So my bibliography, I don't know, it's like 10 pages long or something like that, but it's full of great sources. And I'm very, and that's very important to me as a writer. I would be horrified if someone didn't feel like they had been credited for something that influenced my work.
Oh, yeah.
As I would be angry if I saw something of my own in someone's book and uncredited, you know? Not that we don't all sometimes have simultaneous ideas and things.
True, yeah.
But yeah, the research was intense, but honestly, so fun. I mean, it wasn't fun when it came down to the last 4 days and I was still, like, stressing out how to include a couple of plants that I had cut and some things like that. But that part wasn't so fun. Actually, stayed up like all night for like an entire week, trying to meet that deadline. But reading plant books and reading fairy tales and finding these connections, it was actually a real joy to do that. And I really enjoyed writing it.
Yeah, it feels like it would be very satisfying, you know, on the. Looking back, and then in it, you're in the weeds and it gets kind of hectic, but looking back, it sounds amazing.
I mean, I had probably 5 or 6 more plants that I thought I could squeeze in there. And it just was, I was already over word count, and I knew I was going to have this really long bibliography. And you know, you have to be mindful of that, because I also knew that they were going to make it full color and illustrated.
Yeah.
And so page count's real important with that, because it's a tight budget.
Oh, yeah.
You can't just add. And the thing is you can't just add one page to a book. It has to be in signatures of 8 or 16 because of the printing process. Okay. So you can't just add in an extra page at the end. Like, you know, if you're making it yourself, you could.
Right.
But when you're working with because of the way the paper's folded and all of that stuff, it's got to be in signatures of 8 or 16. So, and then you get that up, and then that raises the price point and it makes the book less accessible to people. So I was, you know, just trying to be mindful of that. And I just thought, you know, you can't include everything. It's not an encyclopedia.
Right.
It's a collection. True. And, you know, there's probably enough for another, I don't know, there's enough for a whole other book, but I've got probably, you know, 20,000 words worth of outtakes. Things that I took out because, you know, there wasn't room for them.
Too much. And do you take a sizable break between your books or when you start working on your next book? Like, or
ideally
you
not.
Already have, okay. You already have the idea for like, as you're working, say on this book, did you already have kind of in the back of your mind what you were going to do next?
And oh yeah.
Roll right
oh yeah.
Into it?
Okay. I always have like 4 or 5 million-dollar ideas percolating at any given time.
Okay.
So what worked out nicely with this one, so the ideal is actually that you get a little time to focus on you have to do a lot of your own outreach and publicity. And then like with this book, I've been getting more speaking engagements. Like I've been contacted by botanical gardens and places like that, and libraries and things. So you want to be able to give yourself some time to kind of like strategize and work on that. And also once you turn the manuscript in, there's other parts to the process. You have to go through the copy editing phase and you have to approve that. And then you go through the proofreading phase and approve that. So there's some time that comes in there. And then actually right as this one was coming out, so of course it had been a year since I had completed it, just before that in like January, that's when I started, maybe actually even in December, that's when I started working on the zine, which was, you know, it's like 6,000 words. So it was a decent length. So I started working on that. So that was really nice because I had that to work on while I was kind of waiting for Enchanted Plants to, you know, hit the stands or whatever, so to speak. And then I've tried to apply some of that like antsy creative writing energy to, like I said, you know, creative marketing stuff or just doing a lot of outreach, you know, submitting forms to different conferences and book award things or, you know, or book, you know, book fairs and things like that.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, in January, I pitched the publisher three more ideas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I just heard back from them. And so I just need to kind of do. So because I've worked with them before, I can get away with just sending like a paragraph of what I'm thinking. And then the editor responds and says, I like this one. Can you give me a more fleshed out proposal? So that's my next thing is to do this. Flesh out proposals for a couple different ideas and then see which one they go for. Or maybe they'll want both of them and I'll just be writing, which is fine with me. The other thing I do with my time is I actually teach a lot of creative writing. I run some creative writing groups at my local art center and I teach a lot of like just fun creative writing classes. And I work with teen writers a lot. So that occupies some of my brain space, but it is hard for me to, at this point, to really write, like really work on a book project if I don't know that I have a deadline and some interest. It's just, right. I mean, it's just like the habit that I'm in.
Right.
So that's just kind of how I work. Like, oh, what's my next book going to be? But there's a long time in between my last books. I mean, the Paranormal Parlor came out in, I think, 2018.
Oh, okay.
It's been quite a while since I've had a new book out.
Yeah, that is okay. And you kind of touched on my next question even. So you do teaching and maybe mentoring type stuff with creative writing. Do they ask for advice? Like, do you have kind of general advice you give young people kind of up and coming trying to maybe even in the same genre you're in?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do not consider myself a gatekeeper and I never want to be a gatekeeper. So any information I have, I willingly share that. Yeah. Whether that's actually helpful or not is, you know, not always the case, right? I mean, but I give out any information, any contacts, anything I have freely and always will, especially to young aspiring writers, but to any, I mean, I've got writers that are, 13 and I've got writers who are 90 in my groups.
Yes. So yes. Not necessarily young, but just, I guess, newer writers, right? Or people who are,
I mean, I think
embarking.
I think my main role, at least with the community that I work with now, is not so much to like give them great advice, but to keep them inspired and give them the confidence that they are writers and that they deserve to give themselves that title and that creative energy. And sometimes it's okay just to create for creation's sake. Yeah. And, you know, just encouraging people to kind of like follow that dream. A lot of people have put that on hold because they had to have a, you know, square job and take care of their family and, you know, take care of their children. And so it's, I feel like that's more of my role is just to like, you know, I mean, I'll give whatever I'm a little bit better at giving like organizational, like developmental editing advice than I am like, I mean, I my publishing advice is like, yeah, as much as I know, from working in publishing and from being published, but just, that's not always going to help someone, you know, like it's what, like if you can get an agent, well, not everyone can get an agent. It depends on what you write. And not a lot of like paranormal nonfiction people, you know, with agents so much. We just kind of pitching directly to the working directly with the publishers. But like, you know, if you're a historical fiction novelist, and you got a good idea, like you probably would do well to get an agent, because otherwise you're never going to get it to, you know, Harper Collins or whatever.
Right.
Although they've left a bad taste in my mouth after what they did to Emily Grant Hutchings all those years.
That's right. Holding the grudge.
Same company.
For her.
It just evolved over the over time. Yeah.
That's right. Okay.
Collins then got involved.
I have one more question for you that I I'll be sad if I don't ask you. But do you have a lesser known kind of myth or creature or any kind of legend that you think deserves more attention?
Well, my number one favorite. Okay. My number one favorite creature is a banshee.
Okay. Okay.
Absolute favorite.
Okay.
And in fact, my book, which is Banshees, Werewolves, and Vampires. Now that came out in, I want to say like 2015 or something like that. And at the time, everything was vampires. It's like vampire, vampire, vampire. And I was like, I really don't want this to be vampires, banshees, and werewolves. Or werewolves, vampires, and banshees. It's like, I want banshees up front. Mark my words, banshees are going to make a comeback.
Comeback, okay.
And so the publisher was just kind of like, fine, whatever. We can put banshees up there. But I love banshees because essentially, like, if you're not familiar with what a banshee is, it's a harbinger of death. It's a psychopomp into the other world. And it sort of straddles the world of the fairies and the other world and ghosts.
Yeah.
So it has a lot of qualities. Many of the counterparts to banshees in other cultures beyond Ireland and Scotland are actually referred to as ghosts, like the woman in white or some kind of like ghost that appears right before someone dies. But what a banshee does is you either hear it or see it or both. And it has this like super mournful cry, kind of like, you know, keening at a funeral. And it alerts you that someone is gravely ill and will die. And it's not you. It's not your own death. It's not a harbinger of your own death. It's the death of someone that you know. Always kind of depicted as female. There are stories about them being women who died in childbirth, women whose children died. Women who committed filicide, all kinds of speculation about that. But the name Banshee actually translates in Irish to like, Banshee means of the fairy mound. So they're sort of fairy women, but they often appear as like these sort of supernaturally beautiful women with long flowing dark hair and pale skin and terrifying craggy teeth. Sometimes they appear as old little hags. There's the washerwoman version, which is as you're marching to battle, if you look down toward the creek and you see a woman bent over washing out bloody rags, it means you're going to die in battle. There's a lot of variations of it. But that's my, just so, La Llorona is kind of a variant of that as well. And so, I think that's probably my favorite. I also love a good puka, you know, the trickster fairy that preys on drunks. It's just so fun.
Always with a slight like morality tale, you know, woven in there, you know.
You stayed too late at the pub again.
That's right. Don't let them catch you out. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with me, Varla. It was a pleasure speaking with you and learning all about you.
It was an absolute delight to get to talk with you and meet you, and I hope we meet again.
I hope so, too. Thank you. And before I wrap up, there are a couple of announcements I have. First, as you probably noticed, there wasn't an episode last month of Women of the Paranormal. So to make up for it, I might do a bonus episode later this month if all the stars align. So keep watching the space and we'll see if that goes up. Also, a new Paranormal Perception episode was released recently. If you haven't listened to it, do so when you can. It's a very interesting one. Plus, the best part, Henry's giving away a chance to stay overnight in a real haunted house. You definitely have to go check that out. I'm Amanda Ashley, and you can follow me on my Instagram at The Spooky Storyteller, and I will talk to you all next time on an all-new episode of Women in the Paranormal. Until then, take care of your spooky self.
That was this month's featured Woman in the Paranormal. If you know of someone who needs to be featured in an upcoming episode, visit paranormalperception.show and click on the Women in the Paranormal link on the homepage. You can listen to past episodes, learn more about Amanda Ashley, and you can suggest a woman whose contributions need to be highlighted in one of these episodes.
Paranormal Perception presents Women in the Paranormal was recorded, edited, produced, and distributed by 22 Creations Multimedia, LLC.